The center of gravity of the project is more devoted to public uses than to private. Why? Because it has to become the heart of a whole new city.
Renowned Spanish architect Santiago Calatrava is one of the bright minds behind Greenwich Peninsula, an enormous new city within a city development here in London. That's just one of the highlights we'll revisit on this special edition of Section D. Hello from Midori House in London, I'm Ben Rylan and you're listening to a special edition of our dedicated design show, Section D. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll round up some of the biggest design stories of the year, including an exhibition that looked back at the lasting legacy of Zaha Hadid.
She wouldn't have made the difference or would have disliked the difference between architecture and visual arts. She would have wanted a harmonious and peaceful merging of both disciplines.
And as the United States struggled to agree on what to do with the statues that recall its difficult past, we found out how the city of Budapest put its own contentious history into a new context.
The positioning of the statue park in itself is very interesting because it's not in the centre of the city, it's not in the middle of nowhere, it's just outside the city. So it sort of shows the ambiguity of Hungary's relationship with communism.
Then we'll revisit the clever folk at fashion startup Farfetch to find out how they're reviving retail by blending the benefits of online with the physical store.
Farfetch has always believed that the physical retail space is here to stay, it just needed technology to augment it. And store of the future is that technology.
All that coming up on this special edition of Section D. Zaha Hadid's death last year yielded all manner of retrospective rumblings about the architect's career, drawing praise and ire in equal measure. It's strange to think then that between setting up her office in 1977 and building the now fettered Vitra Fire Station in Weil am Rhein in 1993, she didn't complete a single structure. Instead, she drew, painted, and pondered. The productive period was the subject of a show at the Serpentine Sackler Gallery, itself designed by Hadid in London's Hyde Park, called Zaha Hadid, Early Paintings and Drawings. Many of them were submitted as actual propositions to understandably bewildered clients. Henry Rhys Sheridan spoke to the Serpentine's Amira Gad about the polarizing firebrand's formative years.
As you enter the exhibition space, the first painting that you see is called Metropolis, and it's from 1988. This is a painting that Zaha Hadid was commissioned to do for an exhibition at the ICA in London. It was a group exhibition presenting the work of emerging architects. And this is, in a way, her first formulation or ideas of a vision for the city of London. It's quite abstracted and it's predominantly red. And we already start seeing how Zaha's thinking around the urban fabric is exploding and fragmented. It's moving away from the epicenter of the city. And this idea of gravity is starting to be challenged. For her, a city can be built underground and go up to the skies. And this idea of gravity and how to use space is being challenged in her work. And this is something that she will continue doing throughout her career, and something that will eventually translate as well in her buildings and her architecture, especially in the sense of they're often referred to as weightless. They seem weightless as one of the predominant characteristics of her architecture. And this is an element that we already start seeing in this particular painting. Another thread that also reemerges in another painting also included in the show that's called 2066, London 2066, is the color of the river Thames in London, which appears as orange and yellow. And this is another thread that comes back 10, 15 years later in her work.
So just to get this straight, I tell you what, I'm going to try to describe the painting first. So it is extraordinarily abstract, as you say. I can see some forms in a detail of the painting which do kind of resemble a city, but for the most part it looks a little bit like a kind of abstract jigsaw puzzle. And just to clarify, this was presented in the context of an exhibition in which other young architects were presenting their work, their plans, would the other plans that this would have been presented alongside been more conventional in nature? And if so, how was this received next to them?
Well, that's, I think, a very important question and point that you're bringing up, because it is one of the what makes Zaha Hadid's painting so special. Most of her works, or the paintings that you see, were submitted as proposals to architectural competitions, except what Zaha Hadid did at the time is not submit a realistic depiction of a design. She submitted an abstract painting, a fragmented forms that are depicted in her work. And that's, I think, quite special, because what she essentially did is that she didn't present her client with a fait accompli. They weren't presented with an idea of how it will, that architecture or the urban fabric or a development of a city should exactly be. What Zaha, I would argue, did is that she invited her viewer and her clients to imagine, along with her, the potentiality of architecture.
And were these types of paintings, when they were initially presented, before her name was made, when they were presented to clients, how were they received? Because I can't imagine that this was what they were expecting.
No, it was not, probably not what they were expecting, because they were expecting a realistic depiction of a design. So I think that probably is the reason behind the time that it took for Zaha Hadid's career to pick up. She started her office, Zaha Hadid, at the time it was called the Office of Zaha Hadid, in 1979, so just a couple of years after she graduated from the AA. And it took her up until 1993, before she was commissioned her first building in Germany. One would argue that, of course, it is because of her decision to maintain the presentation of her proposals in these abstract forms. Of course, there was also another turning point in her career before the commissioning of a building, and that's the Peak series, which is also included in this exhibition. Maybe we can go there and I can...
Let's do it. And while we're walking there, perhaps I can ask you a question related to what you were just talking about, which is the fact that in spite of not having conventional commercial architectural success, through this method of unorthodox proposal, she stuck with it. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of integrity we would normally associate with the biography of a visual artist. Mm-hmm. Now, the Serpentine galleries normally exhibit contemporary visual art. Was Zaha Hadid a contemporary visual artist?
I would argue that yes. And I would also say that for Zaha Hadid, she wouldn't have made the difference or would have disliked the difference between architecture and visual arts. She would have wanted a harmonious and peaceful merging of both disciplines. And if we look at the span of Zaha Hadid's career, we also see that she had a wide interest. She didn't only paint, and this exhibition is a celebration of her paintings and Zaha Hadid as an artist. And she painted, she did architecture, she did clothes, she was involved in fashion, she was also involved in product design. So in that sense, Zaha Hadid's involvement, let's call it the creative industries or creative field, was that she really put her hands in everything and didn't necessarily believe in this separation. So I think that's the best way to describe Zaha.
Thank you, Henry. Few news watchers would have missed reports of the deadly eruption of violence at a rally of white supremacists in the U.S. city of Charlottesville this year. The confrontation initially centered around the removal of a Confederate statue of the Southern General Robert E. Lee. And aside from providing another less than satisfactory chapter in the gaffe-prone presidency of one Mr. Donald Trump, the episode sparked debate over how the United States has, and should deal with the undesirable echoes of its Confederate past. But the US isn't alone in needing to confront a difficult history that comes to a head in the concrete form of a statue. Many former Soviet states have been forced to face uncomfortable questions over how to deal with monuments and statues that were originally designed to celebrate now defunct ideologies. Some nations, such as Ukraine, have banned Soviet symbolism, but Hungary has taken a different approach to its Eastern European cousins. Memento Park opened in 1993, just a few years after the collapse of the Iron Curtain. By welcoming visitors to learn about the nation's history, the park presents the city's polarizing symbolism in a new context. Monocle's Budapest correspondent Adam Labor took us on a tour.
In October 1944, when the Red Army crossed into Hungary, the Hungarians welcomed them as liberators. But in Budapest, the fighting was at its fiercest.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The chief state TV channel was halfway through its evening news when it got the first details of the agreement signed in Minsk. Quoting from it, the anchorwoman announced, "The Soviet Union, as a subject of international and geopolitical reality, no longer exists."
The Memento Park, or as we call it sometimes in Budapest, the Statue Park, is a large area just outside the city where all the statues of the communist era, Lenin and Marx and heroic Soviet soldiers, have been placed. And the idea was that after communism, people said, well, what should we do with these statues? So some people were saying they should be destroyed. Some people were saying they should be left in place. Not many. Most people wanted them moved out. But a very sensible decision was taken to keep them because they are part of Hungary's history. And the positioning of the statue park in itself is also very interesting because it's not in the center of the city. It's not in the middle of nowhere. It's just outside the city. It's about 45 minutes to get there. So it sort of shows the ambiguity of Hungary's relationship with communism. Because under communism, Hungary was known as the happiest barracks or as having goulash communism. And there was a sort of social contract that if you don't make too much trouble, we'll let you go to Austria every 2 or 3 years. We'll let you do a bit of smuggling. You can have some Western goods, a bit of private enterprise. You know, people weren't being tortured or really beaten up in Hungary by the late 1980s. It was a sort of softish communism. It was still a dictatorship. So nowadays, many people, especially older people that haven't really managed to make the transition to the much tougher free market economy, remember those days with some sympathy and with some affection. So the statue park represents that ambiguity of the country's relationship with communism. I can't imagine you'd go there if you didn't know anything, because the more about the history that you know, even just the basic idea that Eastern Europe was under communist rule from after the Second World War till 1990 would give you an understanding of it. But the word looming is very good. A lot of Soviet era and Soviet style architecture does kind of loom over you. And that was intentional to show the kind of grandeur of the system, that great forces were at play, that these statues of these leaders, Lenin, Marx and Engels, they were kind of the inventors and the interpreters of really grand historical forces that shaped lives and made new societies. And so you were meant to be almost a bit intimidated by them. So you would come in and you would see Lenin and Marx and Engels, you would see some statues of Soviet soldiers. There's one statue there called Ostapenko, which is a Russian soldier holding a white flag. And that used to be on the outskirts of Budapest. And that some people, quite a lot of people, said that should have stayed, because everyone knew that when they came back from their summer holiday at Lake Balaton, they went past Ostapenko's statue. They were back in the city. And his story was that him and a couple of other Russian soldiers, at the end of the war, when the Germans were retreating and the Russians were advancing, went forward with a white flag to say, look, you know, we're on the way, you're done, so why don't you surrender? But he was shot, so they turned him into a kind of a martyr. So there's a lot of the city's history there. If you go there with some knowledge of the city's history, you get a lot out of the visit. It's also very well explained. It's not just a load of statues in a field. It's quite a well-organized theme park. You can listen to speeches of former communist leaders. There's quite a lot of jokey souvenirs you can buy. But I think it's a very good place. It's good that it exists and that these statues have been kept. Some of them are quite amazing pieces of art. It's very interesting because in the city, under communism, these statues in major downtown places. I mean, I remember in 1991, Marx and Engels were still in a park. Right by the Margaret Bridge near the Danube. But that statue now has been moved to the Memento Park. They were certainly intended to, at least, if not intimidate you, remind you, you know, you are in a communist country. Lenin's sayings are to be revered and to be obeyed. These are the people that have made the ideology that shapes your life. So it was sending a very clear message.
President Truman's dramatic announcement that Russia has created an atomic explosion sends reporters racing for Flushing Meadow, where Russia's Vyshinsky arrives to address the United Nations.
Mr. Vyshinsky, have you got any statement about President Truman's statement on the atomic bomb?
Please,
does Russia have the atomic bomb?
It's saying that these were part of our history. This is what this ideology was. And this is what people lived through. And now you come and see the statues and you can see the people, the way that this ideology was manifested on the streets. But we haven't destroyed it. We're not saying this never happened. This happened. We lived through it. These were the upsides, these were the downsides. And now you can have a think about that, about what it means. I think, for example, if you look at what's happening in America over the statues of the Confederate generals, rather than taking them down and smashing them, to put them in something similar and built around, obviously, the idea of the Confederacy, the Civil War, slavery, and its continuing reverberations in American society, which are obviously extremely strong, would be a very sensible way forward, because what it does is it takes them, it kind of quarantines them in a way. It takes them out of the everyday furious debates and anger and claim and counterclaim, and it says, it happened. They're here, they're in this context, go and look at them. You can think about why these statues were built, what were the people thinking, good things or bad things, and discuss it and talk about it, because I think discussing and talking about these things is a much better way forward than ripping them down all the time. Because if you rip them down, it just increases the rancor and the anger on both sides. I think the fact that it's there and it's available as a resource is a very good thing. And it would be great if, you know, for example, school children were taken there and shown around to say this is what the history is. I mean, history in Central and Eastern Europe is very, very live and very sensitive subject. So the fact that it's there, it's waiting, is good.
Monocle's correspondent in Budapest, Adam Labor, taking us inside the city's Memento Park. Back to London now, where earlier this year, Hong Kong-owned developer Knight Dragon announced plans for an £8.4 billion urban development scheme that will transform London's Greenwich Peninsula. At its heart is a gargantuan complex of new buildings, cultural venues, public spaces and transport links that will be designed by Santiago Calatrava, a first for the Spanish architect here in the UK. Calatrava is used to building on a vast scale. He's responsible for the City of Arts and Sciences in Valencia and is the architect behind the mooted tower at Dubai Creek Harbour, which, when completed, will be taller than the vertiginous Burj Khalifa. New Yorkers will also recognise his butterfly-like World Trade Centre, Path Station, in Lower Manhattan. Calatrava is, however, no stranger to controversy. Many of his detractors cite delays and overspends as hallmarks of some of his more ambitious projects. But his fans see his envelope-pushing and eye-catching designs as some of the most unique and innovative of our age. Monocle's contributing editor David Michon got comfy with Calatrava at the Lanesborough Hotel in London to speak about the ongoing project and why he's always wanted to leave a mark on London.
I first wanted to just ask you a question about your trajectory, because obviously you have found a lot of success now, but what for you were the kind of milestones to get to the place you are now and the place your practice is today?
Well, certainly there is a project who was crucial that I have done when I was 33. It was the railway station in Zurich, Stadelhofen. And it was crucial because it was the confrontation with all the difficulties that bring in itself, you see, to design a railway station from the technical point of view, but also because it was a project in the middle of the city and also in a very sensible place of the city, in which several parts of the city was coming together in a delicate transition point between green areas of the city and more consolidated city plazas, and then having to do with all the problems of the emissions, the impact, and also following almost in a day by day during 8 years, you know, the evolution of the project until the full construction. So I think this was the place where I had done my master, if you want to say it like that, isn't it? It took me more than 8 years, you see. And then this is an important project, I have to say. I'm working now in building the Church of St. Nicholas at ground zero. Physically, it's a tiny project in relation to the gigantic towers, but full of meaning, isn't it? And also the first time I am building a religious building. In this profession, you never stop. All the projects are crucial, isn't it? All the projects are important.
Mentioning the Zurich station is maybe a good segue into talking about why you're here in London, which is obviously the Greenwich Peninsula and Peninsula Place, which is not only a transportation hub, but combines a lot of different uses, a lot of them cultural uses, theaters, cinema, performance spaces. My question, kind of looking at that project, is, you know, at a time when I think a lot of kind of culture like that is being squeezed, why do you think those are still quite critical elements of building a new or renewing an urban environment?
Looking at the project today, you will see there is a bridge, there is a transportation hub. They are public spaces, gallerias, plazas. They are also places in which people can, let's say, they are shops, they are places for exchange, for contact of people, for movement of people. There is a park, there is a crescent, they are arcades. There is even a construction in the water, isn't it? So in a way, you see, I think the client was looking for something like that. If you look backwards, you see, the client, I suppose, he balanced accurately, you know, who is the person who is capable to deliver a project who is more, let's say, the center of gravity of the project is more devoted to public uses than to private. Why? Because it has to become the heart of a whole new city, call it like that, isn't it? Because the peninsula means almost an island, you see. And indeed, it's so beautiful geographically how the Thames meanders around and create this peninsula. You can go from one side into the other rather quickly and see from, you face east, you face west, isn't it? And you can do that maybe in a walk who takes you, let's say, 7 to 10 minutes, depending, you know, how. And we has also recreated this walk, isn't it? Our project has mark and line, getting from one side to another, and a walking green with trees. When the trees, the natural trees, enters into the buildings, are still there. Oh. And even the tree becomes a metaphor, making all those roofs who looks also a little bit like trees. Finally, the point is that the client was very conscious he need to create a new center. And he needs somebody who has experience in public spaces, because the project, at least this part of the project, has an enormous significance for the consolidation of a new urban area with a center, with a civic center, call it like that, because, of course, you see the O2 Arena is there and remains also untouched and also undiscussed, the element who is landmarking the area, isn't it? It's not. If you look also at the photomontage of our buildings, what we are creating is a conurbation. So, I mean, I think in this matter, getting out of this conviction, I think we have done together with my client a work, you see, who has an enormous city-related vocation, isn't it? It's certainly not the typical building, you see, who is put in a plot and reach a high, has a depth, but is much more than that. It's a series of buildings who speak with each other and wants to articulate around them the new coming city.
Spanish architect Santiago Calatrava there, speaking to Monocle's David Michon about the plans for the Greenwich Peninsula in southeast London. Now to the world of fashion and retail. Since starting in 2008, Farfetch has become one of the most successful online fashion startups. It works by providing a backlit platform on which retailers can sell their wares without having to invest in an expensive site of their own. Now, the founder, Jose Neves, and team are eyeing up how physical, embodied shopping can bolster their business. Earlier this year, the brand revealed the prototype for the Farfetch OS, a way of using the data gathered online to recommend items to shoppers in-store. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco visited the launch, and he spoke to Stephanie Fair, Chief Strategy Officer for Farfetch.
So I think what often people don't realize with big successful tech companies is that they've taken a while to get to where they have. José launched Farfetch end of 2008 on a very simple idea, which was how could technology and the internet enable these boutiques that were in all sorts of remote parts of the world to leverage a global audience. And people were starting to think in a global way. And that same idea has carried through in everything that Farfetch has done over the last 8-9 years. And that strong mission statement, which we define as to be the global platform for luxury, remains now. So all new innovation and everything that Farfetch does in future relates back to that mission. And I think that's the genius of José as an entrepreneur. It's a very simple statement, but it informs the future. Store of the Future is a big plan for Farfetch in 2017 and 18. And Store of the Future is the evolution of that original platform premise. Store of the Future is essentially saying we've connected these boutiques and brands, we've put them online, we've given them an online audience. Now, how do we enable that same data and that same service that you get online in terms of personalization and recommendations, how can we actually bring that to the physical retail space? And Farfetch has always believed that the physical retail space is here to stay. It just needed technology to augment it. And Store of the Future is that technology. It's a suite of tools and technologies which boutiques and brands can choose to take everything or parts of it or bring third parties into it. The common goal is to capture data about the customer between their online and their offline journey to give them a better service.
Sandrine Deveux, MD of the Store of the Future, tells me a bit more about the concept of the shop.
So what you're going to see today is just a beta version of the Store of the Future project. Our tech team has been working over the last 18 months on selecting a few technology, and obviously this is just for the purpose of this event. So let's have a look at the first step of the journey. I'm going to show you, two things. We're going to look at the experience when a customer enters the stores between myself with the customers and Ferrari is playing the role of the sales associate. So we start with these key facts where we know that 90% of the sales are still happening in store. However, digital is still influencing a lot of our purchase decision. So really trying to find out how we can replicate this online behavior in store and really start to create that single customer view. So this morning we had Bain, was talking about data privacy, and they were telling us as over 75% of customers are happy to give data to brands they trust in exchange of value. So what we looked at different types of technology in the market for customer recognition, like eye beacons or camera sensors, as we believe is really important for brands to be transparent with customers or how they use the data. If you look at you, for example, the way you're actually sharing your data online, you're accepting cookies, you're looking on the website, so which is why this is kind of a common behavior. So we concluded it's really important to give the customer the choice to either opt in or opt out in the service they want to receive.
Stephanie Fair, Chief Strategy Officer at Farfetch, speaking to Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And you can find out more by visiting farfetchos.com. Well, that's all for this week and for 2017. We hope you've enjoyed another year of design here on Monocle 24. Now, we will, of course, be back with a fresh new program in the new year. Thanks, as ever, to our editor, Christy Evans, and our researcher, Daphne Karnesis. I'm Ben Rylan. Enjoy the holidays, and we'll catch you in 2018.